Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Pure Hoops podcast most definitely does reflect the views of our management. Here's three-time NBA champ BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman.
Welcome to the Pure Hoops Podcast. I'm Eric Newman. As you know, my partner BJ Armstrong won 3 championship rings with the Chicago Bulls, the first of Chicago's 2 three-peats. On Thursday, BJ and I had the pleasure of reminiscing with one of his teammates on those championship teams, Will Perdue. The interview was so good, we're splitting it into 2 parts over this week and next. They talked about the credit due to Jerry Krause, their struggles with learning the triangle offense, and Michael Jordan's intensity in practice. Let's get right to it. Here's part 1 of BJ and I with Will Perdue.
BJ, of course, top of mind, top of everybody's mind the last couple of weeks. And of course, coming up again Sunday night, The Last Dance. You and I have a lot to talk about. But before you and I go off on our mission, we've got a special guest today, 4-time NBA champion, former teammate of yours with the Chicago Bulls, the one and only Will Perdue. Will, thanks for jumping on with us today to talk The Last Dance.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate you having me on. And listen, this is a great opportunity for me to thank BJ for helping make me the player that I was. You gotta remember, when I played, big men had a rule, 3 dribbles maximum. So in order to get the basketball, in order to score, we had to do 2 things. 1, get an offensive rebound, or 2, highly depend on and develop a relationship with the guards to pass you the basketball.
So what was being leveraged to get you the ball?
Well, I think my number was I had hit 80% of my shots on passes from him.
So that's silly. Why he had some assist numbers.
That's my guy, you know.
But I will say, if you miss the bunny that he passed to you, and then next time down the floor we're running the offense, he may give you the old 1-2 ball fake look into the post and then just pass it on to the top of the key.
I'm sure you got a combination of side eye and look off immediately.
Will, come on, Will. Come on. I always took care of the big fellas. You know that, Will. I always took care of the big fellas.
Yeah, that's because you needed Will to set those down screens for you. Come on, man.
Yeah, this is true. This is
but,
true.
But, you know, jumping in here, you know, you guys obviously have a unique bond and, you know, came to the Bulls in back-to-back years while they were climbing the mountain. Will comes in the 88 draft, 11th overall. BJ the following year in 89, the 18th overall. And the Bulls at this point are in the early stages of their rivalry with the Detroit Pistons and trying to become that next team in the East to take the torch and get to the mountaintop. And BJ, we've talked about this a lot with our rivalries, whether it was Philly, Boston, Detroit, and Chicago being next in line. So, you know, Will, when you get to the Bulls, you know, what is that environment and vibe like knowing, you know, we're getting with Michael, Scotty's developing, and we're going to try to put something special together here.
You know, for me, when I first got there, it was a semblance of awe in the sense that, okay, now you're here. But as you talk about, we kind of hit up that first practice and you see how good Michael is. And you've always watched him on TV, but now to be in his presence, you're like, you know, watching on television, as good as he is, still doesn't do it justice. You know, Scottie Pippen, like, you know, you're like, people are sleeping on this guy. You know, Horace Grant, is he's better than what you had thought or heard. So you knew that you had the pieces, but there's two things I remember looking at was one, at that time it was Doug Collins. How does Doug put these pieces together? And two, how do I fit in? Because at the same time that I went there, they also traded Charles Oakley to the Knicks for Bill Cartwright. So, back then when you made a trade, that guy was immediately inserted into the lineup. And by no way did I think I was better than Bill Cartwright, because I had actually didn't know much about Bill Cartwright. I had to rely on, like scouts and information that I got from people. So I was looking forward to the challenge, of getting ready. But that's the other thing is you realize, 10, 15 minutes into that first practice of training camp, this isn't college, man. This is totally different. And even at that point, when you come in willing to accept the challenge, you realize that I have to adjust my expectations of myself, but I also have to change how I'm thinking because of what's going to be required of me, coming in. Because regardless of what you did in college, that means nothing when you step on the floor for the team you're playing for. That's everybody there is like, hey, I don't care what you did in college, you need to prove what you can do here. So it's almost like you have to take a step back before you take a step forward. Very few guys, we all know about, players, MJ being one. I remember, like you saw in the documentary, Orlando Warwards is like, yeah, this guy's our best player right now. Very few guys have that immediate impact when you look at the league as a whole. But it's trying to find your place, trying to find who you are, what your identity is, how do you fit in. And for me, that was difficult because, I didn't necessarily get off to such a great start. But from a team aspect, you saw the pieces. And I just remember also playing that first game against Detroit. You're like, all right, this is the team we're supposed to beat. But you saw that, technically, I think we're better than them on an individual aspect when you go piece by piece. But we got to figure out as a team how we beat these guys. And that was the difficult part. And it, unfortunately, Doug couldn't do it, and it took Phil a little bit and a couple different approaches to get it done.
Hey, Will, you talked about Bill Cartwright, who, I think we both love, admired, meant so much to our team. But he had a nickname, right? I'm going to let you share his nickname. And could you also, Will, talk about his leadership to our group? Because internally, he had a big part behind the scenes of how we developed and shaped us. But could you expand on that just a little bit?
All right. Well, first of all, kid, which nickname? Because we always used to call him Billy C. I called him Elbows because the dude knocked me out of practice literally every day.
Well, the teacher. Why was he called?
Oh, the teacher, yeah. Well, first of all, I the reason why BJ asked that question is because I think if I remember correctly, you gave him that name. So BJ just wants to get the credit, but it actually was a great nickname.
Nice setup, BJ. Nice setup.
I can attest to that because I used to go to lunch a lot with Bill. So where we used to practice at the multiplex, there was a deli attached in that strip mall.
Right.
And after practice, Billy used to, because listen, it's at the end of the day, when we played kid, there was no buffets. There was no food provided. We didn't have a practice facility. We were at a health club with a gym attached to the end. And I don't think people remember this. The floor wasn't even regulation length.
Right.
It was actually 5 or 6 feet shorter.
That is
so
correct.
It was just, but that's where we were practicing. One of the things my agent told me was, is take Bill Cartwright. This guy, he understands the game, and try to pick his brain. Tell him as much, try to get as much out of him as possible about how to play the game and tricks of the trade. And especially, getting scouting reports on the guys you play. So the teacher was a perfect name for him. We used to go to lunch at this deli a lot. One, because he was a veteran, he always made me pay. But two, he would always, answer my questions, and he would help me out to a certain extent. But kid, I remember specifically one time we were having lunch, and I was just like, every once in a while I would ask him a question, he wouldn't answer, and he would just kind of brush it over and move on. And one day I was like, how come you don't answer all my questions? I'll do my best Bill Cartwright impersonation. He was like, listen, you're trying to take my job, so I'm not going to tell you everything. Some things you're going to have to figure out on your own. So that's when I realized that, hey, this isn't personal, but we're both fighting for the same thing. And there, to answer the second part of your question, kid, there was, and listen, he was like this to everybody. You know, he was always, I used to joke because I think he used to dye that little goatee. He would dye like a gray spot in the middle.
Right.
You know, so he always looked older than he was. And because of the beating he had taken, and he had suffered some injuries earlier in her career, he definitely looked a lot older than he really was. And, you know, when you watched him walk and run, you kind of cringed a little bit at times. Yet he truly understood how to play the game. And he was pivotal for our team because it was almost like he was a quiet leader. Like he would, like if you made a mistake, he would kind of give you that look where he would cock his head to the side, like, you know, you're an idiot, you know? But it was one of those things. He didn't necessarily say a lot, but when he did, it was like profound what he said. And I remember one of the things that he used to always hammer on to me and guys on the team was opportunity. You know, he always talked about opportunity's not always going to be knocking. Opportunity is there for us. We need to take advantage of this opportunity, because that was the first time I had heard somebody talk about opportunity being a window. You know, you guys don't understand. You're young. You guys think that that opportunity is always going to be there. It's not. You guys have to take advantage of this opportunity. We're wasting this opportunity. You know, the inability to beat the Pistons. But it was also, I think, Scotty saw that. Michael saw that. Horace saw that. And it took a while. But I think just by Bill constantly sending that message, constantly being the ultimate professional that he was, you know, I think that also, and I know it changed my outlook, but it changed a lot of outlooks, you know. And Eric, I will say this. One thing I could say about BJ coming in as a young guy was he was mature beyond his age. And I don't know if that was, you know, being in Iowa. I don't know if it was his parents. You know, I found myself learning things from him. But I think a lot of that was quietly BJ. He was almost like an educator himself. You know, it was kind of interesting. Here's a young guy coming in straight from college, but yet he had the mentality and the soul of an older, more mature, experienced veteran player. And he was literally a perfect fit for what we needed and what we were looking for. And it's kind of interesting, BJ, you bring up and ask the question about Billy C, because you were like a clone of him almost as far as, but at a different position, but how you approached and looked at the game.
Yeah, I mean, Bill was, he was so unique, and thanks, Will. I mean, those are very kind words, and I really appreciate it. But Bill was, he has such a impact on the pulse of the team. And I think you said it, you were hit dead on when he didn't say much, but when he did say something, it was almost like, it was like he had everyone's attention, right? And you know, as far as the teacher, I mean, I think it was Craig Hodges who really gave him that name. And I remember the first time I drove to the basket, I remember in practice, and Bill was like, you know what? Craig told me this. He was like, you're going to learn why we call him the teacher. And Bill, you know, Bill took it personal when us little guys would drive to the basket, you know, and he was like a rim protector, but he wasn't like a shot blocker, but he played with such a physical presence down there in the post, Will, and you played against him every single day. Thank God I didn't have to do that. But I would imagine the physicality in which he brought to the game and the drills you guys would do. And those, I always remember when we would have those, remember, Will, when we had the bigs down here and the littles down here? And yeah. I can only imagine the pounding that you guys were getting from Bill when you were doing your drills.
Well, you know, the funny thing was he shot his shot. Everybody talks about how unique and ugly his jump shot was, but he shot it with the purpose of protecting the basketball with his elbows. You know, the way he would wind up, it was almost like, you know, hey, if you want to block my shot, go right ahead, but you're going to pay the price, you know, because of the way that he shot the basketball. But I remember one of the first times we were doing that, kid, and we were on each end of the floor. And I think it was more Johnny Bach than anybody else. You know, Johnny Bach pulled me aside and said, hey, you need to be very careful with this guy. And not in a negative way, but he was like warning me that Bill plays a certain way. And as you talked about, he plays with a physical presence. But I specifically remember Johnny saying, do not take it personally. He's not trying to hurt you. But at some point, he is going to hit you, and you're going to be like, what the hell?
Yeah,
I remember one drill, he reverse pivot. He hit me so hard in the side of the head that my ear turned black and blue. Never heard of that happening or seen that until it happened to me. And this was Bill Cartwright's humor. Like, we're shooting free throws, like, a lot of times. Okay, at the end of practice, get to the basket, shoot two free throws, you know. And one time he came up to me and he goes, hey, let me see your elbows. And he'd, like, rub his hand across my elbows, you know, like he was putting lotion on or something. I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, here, he took my hand and put it on his elbows. It was like a jagged cliff edge. And he goes, you'll see. He goes, give it a couple of years.
Sharpening the tools.
Yeah, he said, if you use your elbows right, they'll feel like mine in a couple of years. And I'm like, what? That? And I remember we used to make fun of Bill because after every game, he had his ankles in two buckets of ice. He had ice on his knees. He had ice on his elbow. I mean, he literally was, you know, and he was the only player, if I remember correctly, that initially had his own ice machine at his house.
Right, right.
Because he constantly said he was basically icing 24/7 in order to play. And we used to give him a hard time. And he's like, give it time.
Yeah.
Give it time.
That's what he would always say. He would say that.
Yeah.
Laugh all you want now, but I'll call you in a couple of years and you'll be like, you know, you were right. So. You know, it's kind of like, you're right, kid. It's kind of like the teacher. I mean, he was, it's kind of interesting as we, you know, and that's the other thing that I've been telling people about this documentary, because, you know, doing podcasts and interviews, it's amazing some of the things that you forgot that are brought back to the surface that as you see here, just kind of make you laugh that was all part of the whole experience.
Yeah, and Will, that's a perfect segue to my next question. And, you know, somewhat jokingly, I mean, Bill was on some pretty bad Knicks teams in New York, so him getting into a different situation and taking it out on you young guys was probably part of that too. But all joking aside, things that are forgotten about, that 89 season, you know, you guys are very competitive. And this is, to remind people, this is right before BJ was drafted. You guys are very competitive, but you're the sixth seed in the playoffs, and you're facing a rising Cleveland Cavaliers team in the first round, who's a three seed. And correct me if I'm wrong, but most people were writing you guys off. And game five in Cleveland, of course, sets up a momentous moment, which is the first Michael Jordan shot. But you're then propelled into the second round of the playoffs. And who are you facing? Of course, the New York Knicks. And Bill, I'm sure, had some insight as to how to handle them in the second round. What was it like getting through Cleveland with that moment and then, you know, navigating the Knicks? And all of a sudden, you guys have broken through to the conference finals in 1989, where, of course, the Pistons were waiting.
Right. Well, first of all, you know, getting to game five was, you know, a task in itself. because you're right. You know, we were just a sixth seed. You know, we at that point we weren't running the triangle yet. Doug Collins is the coach. You know, the one thing I will say about that team was is the immaturity of that team. You know, showed itself, and that was part of the learning process because of the fact that, you know, okay, we had MJ, we had Pax, veteran players, we had, you know, Bill Cartwright, but yet we were leaning heavily on Scottie Pippen and, you know, and Horace Grant and then, you know, some other guys that is just kind of, you know, looking at the team itself as far as the starting group, you know, and you had the ups and downs of Scottie, you had the ups and downs of Horace, you know, I didn't really play a lot, but it wasn't like we were facing dire adversity, but, you know, it was the constant clashing of egos, things of that nature of guys coming into the league, guys coming into their own. And you were right. We weren't supposed to beat them. And then Michael hits that shot and it just kind of propels us forward. But it was also one of those things where you're like, considering everything that Bill Cartwright has been through, the fact that he had to play for Hubie Brown, and Bill used to tell me some stories about Hubie. Just Hubie's whole thing was, you know, rookies have to earn their stripes. Rookies don't necessarily play a lot. You got to sit on the bench. You got to watch. You got to figure out how to play the game, you know, and then the injuries that he dealt with. We felt like this was the perfect setup. And again, because like BJ confirmed and I mentioned, you know, he didn't talk a lot. You know, he smiled a lot. He would laugh. He would joke. But he wasn't a very emotional guy, nor was he a very vocal guy. But you knew deep inside that this was now his opportunity to kind of, and you don't want to say get back at a team. This was an organization that drafted him. He had considerable pride. He loved New York. But it's just like, all right, here's my opportunity. We've made the trade. Here's my chance now to show my importance. I know I've unfortunately been through a lot in New York and there's a lot of the things I couldn't control, but this is something that I can help control and I can help. And that's where that leadership aspect of Billy then really kind of took over.
Yeah, and I don't know if people realize Bill Cartwright was a 20-point per game scorer early in his career with the Knicks. And after the 84 season where they took the Celtics to 7 in the second round behind an unbelievable run by Bernard King, the entire next season, 84-85, he's out with an injured foot, and then they draft Patrick Ewing. So I'm sure Bill was in a very a just vulnerable position with what was going to be next in his career. And, you know, he gets healthy. And then, as you said earlier, he gets traded for Charles Oakley to the Bulls for the 88-89 season. And I just want to give people an idea. Michael Jordan in 88-89 averaged 32.5 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists, and nearly 3 steals per game, shooting almost 54% from the floor. This is a season that I think gets overlooked in terms of being pivotal in the development of what became the first part of the dynasty. So, Will, can you paint a picture what Chicago Stadium was like for those NBA playoffs where the fans started to taste what was coming? And if you want to pick it up first with the shot in Cleveland, which, of course, is an unbelievable moment, and then setting up the Knicks series.
Well, I remember the shot as it was at the other end of the floor. So we were all trying to get, you know, we obviously knew what the play was coming out of the timeout. So we were all kind of crouched around, you know, everybody, I think half our team was out on the floor so we could actually see what was going on as everybody started to stand up on the bench. And, you know, they run that play. And then I think sometimes, you know, people talk about the shot, but that was a double pump jump shot that Elo actually provided really good defense for. And it was just an incredible, I mean, listen, you have to say it. It's somewhat luck that he hit it, but that's kind of when, you know, it all started. I think what people also forget is, you know, before Michael got hurt, and that's the next question. What happens with this organization if Michael doesn't get hurt? It doesn't miss, I think it was, what, 67 games? His second year in the league, because you talk about the old stadium. You know, they went from horrible attendance. I have plenty of friends that I've made over the years that had season tickets, most notably up in the second balcony. They said they would start the first quarter sitting in their seats, and by the middle of the second quarter, they're down in the lower bowl, second or third row, mid-court, because nobody went to the games. And then as you know, Michael came in that first season, and as everybody saw in the documentary, he felt like he earned his stripes, you know, in that third game. By the latter half of the season, they started selling out. People were excited. But on a whole, the team still wasn't really that good. And it's just then he gets hurt, and then they kind of get set back. But you kind of, you know, wonder what would happen if he didn't get hurt. But that, first of all, the stadium was a dump. You know,
I loved it though, Will. I loved the stadium. I loved that place.
Oh, I loved it, but it was a dump. I remember my first game. The way you would go into the stadium, at least I would walk across the floor. And I remember stopping and being like, it's freaking freezing in here. What is going on? And they'd be like, oh, there's ice below the floor. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They just put plywood on top of the ice, and then they put a little carpet down, and then they put the floor on top of the plywood. And I remembered when, you know, and like I said, I didn't play a lot my rookie year. I mean, literally my feet would be frozen by the end of the game because all I did was just sit there and watch, you know, because the seats were off the floor the way the seats were. They sat to put the seats up. And so sometimes your feet were sitting right, your feet were right on that plywood, which is just right on top of the ice. But I also remember you'd walk across the floor, and then you'd have to go down these steps to get to the locker room.
Right.
There would always be these cats, and I'd be like, hey, you guys, what's up with these cats? And they'd be like, oh, don't touch the cats. They kill the mice. I'd be like, what? I'd be like, yeah, man, there's a lot of mice in this building. These cats keep the mice under control. I was like, okay, whatever. But then you come down the steps and you take a left, and then that's the other thing. You're like, yo, man, I'm in the NBA. And you walk into this locker room that I swear to you was smaller than any locker room I had ever been in my high school or college career. I was like, what the hell is this? You know, but it was just, but then all your questions were answered when you would gather at the bottom of the steps, you know, have our little huddle. And then the minute, the first preseason game, the minute you'd run up those steps and this, the energy, the explosion, the atmosphere, you were just, again, talked about how it was a dump and small the locker room was. It was unlike anything I had ever experienced in my life as far as, you know, just the fans and their desire for a winner, you know, about what was developing.
Well, Will, I tell you what, the huddle was actually the Cliff Livingston, the good news huddle, right? He was the only one that was talking in the huddle. And but I just want to ask you this, Will, because you, when you came in 88, right? That was your first year, right? 88?
88, 89.
You actually had an opportunity to see the transition of playing when, you know, the way the system that you guys played with under Doug Collins. And then we went to Phil Jackson, and my first year was Phil Jackson's first year. So, Will, can you just briefly talk about the transition, because it was a new system that was put in place, and you kind of saw both. And my big question to you is, did you think that the transition of the style of play was the correct style to actually win? Because, you know, you guys were having some success there. Obviously you didn't beat the Pistons and back then, but did you think that was the right move at that time?
Well, our the way Doug ran it was like most offenses, you know, you had calls, one up, one down. you know, five across, you know, a more, I guess you could say, because of when you compare it to the triangle, you could say the offense that we ran prior to that under Doug was more predictable.
Right.
You know, and it also relied on a lot of, you know, MJ freelancing, a lot of screen roll with MJ. But, you know, when Phil came back that next year and became the head coach and we talked about, okay, we're going to run this offense. And let's, you know, BJ, you understand this. And everybody, let's make sure everybody understands. This wasn't Phil's offense. This was Tex Winter's offense.
Yep.
And, you know, basically Tex would run practice for the first 45 minutes to an hour talking about, okay, we're going to run the triangle. We're going to run the triple post. And this is how you do it. I remember, you know, it had not only got a lot of pushback from Michael, but I don't want to say it's difficult, but I think it's the best way to say is it's intricate because of how the offense works. The offense works it's dictated by what the defense does. And early on, we struggled running the offense because for the offense to really work, to really be smooth, to really hum, all five guys on the floor have to see the same thing from the defense. And Eric, as BJ knows, that didn't happen a lot early on because of guys trying to figure things out. As you know, when you run an offense, if you're thinking about what you're trying to do, you're already a step behind. And that was the other thing, because the offense was so predicated on timing.
Yeah. Okay.
What is the defense doing? And then the timing of how we run the offense is predicated on what the defense is trying to stop or contain or control. And if the timing's off, the offense fails. The offense falls apart. So we used to have the bench was required that when the shot clock hit five, we had to start yelling red. Red, that means that the shot clock's running down. Guys, stop running the offense. Just get the ball in Michael's hands. The closest big runs over and we run a screen roll. That was our bailout.
Yeah. Well, I found out many years later, Will, that you know, we were running the offense just to get the ball to Michael for that red situation. I found out many years, Will, so I thought I'd just let you know.
Well, I don't doubt it, because that was the whole thing. I know there's a lot of pushback from Michael, but at times you kind of felt like you were just going through the motions, because you were just like, what exactly? Because that was the hard part. Even though Tex would explain it, you were like, okay, what exactly are we trying to accomplish within this offense? And, you know, I'll ask you, BJ, I didn't feel like that the offense really became efficient and effective for like a year and a half, almost 2 years, because it's just, that's how intricate it was. So, you know, maybe you'd be like, well, yeah, hold on a second. You said it's not that difficult. Once we figured it out, it was like second nature. You know, you didn't even have to think about it. You didn't, like, when you run one down, you're like, okay, what do I do in one down? Once I thought the defense or the offense became efficient, you just ran down the floor. And when the pass went to a certain spot, you knew exactly what you were supposed to do and how you were supposed to do it. It became second nature. Yeah.
That was going to be my next question for both of you. Do you remember whether it was the practice, the moment, the game, the road trip, whatever it was, where that thing just started to click and hum and you looked at each other and you knew, all right, we're getting this and it's working. Let's keep pushing and getting better. Was there a pivotal moment there?
I'll answer this first before Will. My first year there, my rookie season, Will's second season, I think we all struggled, right? I think everyone struggled with, because it was a new system. And I don't know if Will recalls this, but Will, remember the automatics, right? Like,
yeah.
When to run. And the automatics were always the counters to the offense, right? And I think everyone struggled to understand. You know, it's not enough time here to explain it, but the automatics took precedent over the offense, right, Will? And yep. I was like, what is an automatic, right? We had these plays that were dictated by the defense, and that was kind of an unusual way to play. But where it clicked for me was, Will, remember in practice where we would run this drill it was like three or four teams, right? And the one team would start in the middle of the court, and then there would be like three, there would be two guys waiting to defend. And then remember, yep. Will, you had to cut, you had to touch the middle of the circle, and you would play defense from behind.
Yeah.
And remember that? It was like, it was a total chaos. I mean, I didn't know who was who, what was what, but everyone had to figure out what was going on. And that's when I realized, Will, that the triangle offense was actually a defensive scheme to allow us to play in a chaotic situation. And if you could not, if you could ever play the game on the defensive end, we never had to run the triangle offense. That's what I learned from that drill. And the best part of the games for me playing with those guys would Phil Jackson and the coaching staff would make a substitution, right? And the substitution would always be whichever one had it going in the first quarter, they were going to come out. So if Michael had it going, he stayed in, or Scotty. And the second unit, we would always press. And the games to me always resemble that practice. And remember, Johnny Bach gave us the name, the Doberman game. And we would yep. press. And we would always, because you didn't press with Bill Cartwright. But when Will and you and Scott Williams and Stacey King and myself, and we would come in, and it would just be so chaotic. And only play we would run, if there was a play, was 51 or 52, which was just a screen roll. And then we would play out of it, and we would just press. So to me, that's when it clicked to me, is that let's just run automatics all the time. Because we were actually two different teams, and we were really – our bench, I thought, was like we were providing energy because Michael and Scotty both wanted to play with us a lot of the times, because we would play – it wasn't freelance, but we played at a different pace than the first team, because the first team with Pax and Bill, they would – you know, we ran more sets and we ran more things. We were much more, I think we were probably a better half court team with that group, but the full court play of all of us, because of our youth and our age, I thought was one of the propelling things that allowed me, at least as a guard, to understand the offense.
Yeah. And you know, the interesting thing, that drill you were talking about, it was chaotic because, you know, so people that are listening can understand the person. It was kind of like a 3-on-2, 2-on-1, but it became more of a 3-on-3 situation, because the person that came from half court was a defender. And as the ball passed you, you were allowed to then run to half court, touch the circle, and then you were like the trail defender. You were running in to try to help the two guys that were back trying to defend the three guys coming down the floor. And that's what the chaotic situation was. And then obviously you went the other direction, you know, 2-on-1. But I agree with you, Ken, in the sense that it, when that second unit came in, because the first unit, you know, the one thing that Phil talked about was the ball has to go into the post. The ball right. has to go into the post.
Right.
So they had to come down, and that was part of the frustration with Michael, was they would have to come down and get the ball into Bill and run all the cuts off of Bill in the post. The baseline guy cuts baseline. The wing cuts, you know, does that angle cut, sets the screen for the opposite big down on the block. So they were, I don't want to say they were somewhat predictable, but it was a much slower paced game. Yep. Whereas, as you talk about, you know, you would look out there with, say, by the 4 minute mark, the 3.5 minute mark of the first quarter, it would be four guys coming off the bench and either Michael or Scotty. And then that's when, as you talked about, we would press. We would look to push the ball. We would look to get deflections. We would look to get turnovers. You know, and one of the things that with our group that Phil, I thought, helped us out tremendously is that I, as the five guy or whoever the five guy was, you had a designated man taking the ball out of bounds. So everybody else, with the ball went through the net, everybody else sprinted to the other end of the floor. And then in this case, BJ and Michael or Scotty would then run to free throw line extended on each side, so that if one side was covered, then you sprint underneath the basket and can dump it out to the other side. Everybody has a designated area, but Phil focused on the designated man taking the ball out of bounds was the five. So he always came up as the trailer. And the second thing was, we focused on trying to get you and Michael, or you and Scotty, the ball moving north and south not coming back to the basketball, but you almost doing like a loop so that as you caught the ball, you were on the move heading to the other end of the floor. And then as we got down there, you know, guys had certain cuts, and then me as the trailer or Scott Williams or Stacy, whoever, like if I was the first guy down, whatever, you would either advance the ball from one side of the floor to the other, because that was one of the important aspects of the offense to try to get the defense to move, or you just run straight into the screen roll and allow that guy to come off the screen roll with the movement on the other side of the ball. And it was almost like BJ is exactly right. Initially, it was almost like two different offenses depending on the personnel that was on the floor. And then to start off the second quarter, whoever was still in the game with the second unit then came off the floor, and the guy that went out, meaning Michael or Scotty, then came in and started the second quarter with that second unit. And then we would go 3 or 4 minutes with that group. And the one thing that Phil always pounded into us was, if you're the second unit, you have two jobs. One, if you have the lead, you maintain and extend the lead. And two, if the team is in a deficit, you try to cut that deficit in half by the time the starters come in.
That's right.
So, Will, with the varying styles, and it sounds like you know, pace was really different between first team and second team, and then with what you just shared with Phil's rules, what did that make for the intensity of practice, the scrimmages, the battles that went on? What was some of that like, and how did that make you guys all a better team?
And that's the other thing I realized is how intense practices were. You know, because of, I mean, Michael's competitive nature had a lot to do with it. But at the same time, you know, kind of going back to the Bill Cartwright story, because guys are fighting for playing time. You know, you're talking about now everybody on that floor is in the NBA. And everybody's fighting because they feel like they deserve to play more and they want to play more. So these practices were heated. Practices were very competitive. And that's the other thing. We practiced every day. Remember, Phil's rule was, if we don't play on Sundays, we get Sundays off. If we, you know, because they didn't have all the rules they have now in the collective bargaining agreement. But unfortunately, we played a lot on Sundays because of Michael, and you know, everybody wanted to have Michael on television. So we usually played a lot on Sundays at 12 o'clock, which was in one sense a luxury, because if you're at home, you always were like, oh, this is awesome. A 12 o'clock game will be done by about 2:30. We'll have an opportunity to go out, have a nice dinner, relax, get home at a decent hour. You know, but then we always had practice again on Monday, because it was like the 2 days it seems like that everybody played in the league was on Tuesdays and Fridays and Saturdays. So we didn't have the luxury of having Monday off. But it didn't matter. Practices were just as competitive. Guys didn't sit out. You know, we talked, the one guy that maybe sat out periodically was quite possibly Bill Cartwright. But yet he was still there. He was engaged. He would work out. He'd go through the early part of the drills. And then occasionally when we scrimmaged, he would then Phil would take him out. Even then, you know, Phil would get the Bill Cartwright look, because Bill didn't necessarily think it was necessary for him to sit out practice. But it went back and forth. And I had BJ on a podcast with me last week, and we kind of reminisced about how enjoyable it was that it didn't happen often, but the second unit would occasionally beat the first unit in practice. And MJ would be hot, even to the point where MJ couldn't even accept the fact that we beat him. He wouldn't acknowledge that we beat him. All he would say was, the coaches cheated him. He didn't get no call. Johnny Bach didn't blow his damn whistle. You guys are cheating me.
Yeah, well, that those were some funny. Those were funny.
So
but that's
guys.
The other thing I think BJ will agree, Eric, is that it's almost like the games were, you look forward to the games because the games, you knew how competitive they were going to be, but you also knew the other team didn't know how hard they were going to have to play just to beat us. I don't want to say the games were easier, but it was, A, we didn't have to go against our teammate, but B, it wasn't going to be as tough as what we did the last 3 days in practice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I can imagine what that realization was like as it was happening, and that confirming how hard you guys were working and pushing each other. And just speaking of pushing, you know, in 89, you go up 2-1 on Detroit in the conference finals, and they come back and win three straight and close you out. And, you know, going through that next season, climbing the mountain, and of course, you know, BJ's on the team by then, you know, how much of a motivating factor was Detroit in how hard you guys worked and what you were building day to day?
Well, I don't even think it was, I mean, it was Detroit, but I think it was the realization of how much better we needed to be in the league. Not even thinking about Boston or Atlanta or Milwaukee, you know, back then they were the Bullets, you know, no disrespect to them, but it was just like, we're at a point now where, you know, we need to put ourselves in a position to have the best record possible to have home court. We need to win the games that we're supposed to win. We can't afford to lose games that we're not supposed to lose. We need to put ourselves in a position, you know, to where we get into that situation where when we have a game seven, if necessary, we have it at home. But it was also knowing that as good as they were, you know, there were other things that we needed to work on. You know, hey, yeah, we're trying to beat the Detroit Pistons, but there were other aspects of our game that we needed to work on as well. But it's also, you know, continue to work on making the offense better. Continue working with Johnny Bock on the defensive aspect. But the interesting thing is what we had to do also as far as the mental aspect of how do we go about actually playing the Detroit Pistons and the New York Knicks. And, you know, because again, when I talked about when you started looking at our teams on paper, you know, we had the better athletes. You know, both teams had experience, both teams had skill sets, both teams had veteran players. But I thought that we had the better athletes. But how do we take the better athletes and then turn around and beat the Detroit Pistons? And that's something that we had to learn at the same time.
So one of the big topics coming out of the first two episodes of The Last Dance is, of course, Mr. Jerry Krause and him being portrayed in a, I think it's accurate to say being portrayed in a villainous role, being that, you know, he was partly responsible for breaking up the championship Bulls at the end, but, you know, he drafted both of you guys. So, you know, would love a little back and forth between you guys here on, you know, your relationship with him at the time you were in Chicago and, you know, what he was like, firsthand accounts from you guys.
Well, kid, what was the assistant GM's name back then? It was Billy. What was Billy's last name?
That might have been before I got there. Well, when I came, it was Jimmy Stack, Clarence Gaines were there with Jerry. So,
right.
Yeah, so that might have been before I got there.
Yeah, so my year, there was a guy by the name of Billy, and he might have actually taken another job, which then opened things up for Stack.
Okay, yeah, that was before I got there. That's who was there when I came.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that I dealt with, Eric, was, you know, I had one of the assistants who kind of became, you know, my coach at Vanderbilt was a gentleman by the name of Ed Martin. And Ed Martin knew all the coaches in the NBA. He knew most of the assistants. He knew the general managers. He had been Chuck Robinson's coach at Tennessee State back in the day, and then he eventually came over to Vanderbilt as an assistant. But he had told me about Jerry Krause as he's like, listen, this guy's a little different. All right, but he knows basketball, but he's different. And, you know, Jerry wanted everything to be secretive. You know, don't tell anybody you're coming to work out for us. Don't let anybody know, you know, you're going to be here. Other teams are going to want to know who you're working out for. I don't care what you tell them about, you know, the other teams, but just do not tell them you've worked out for the Chicago Bulls. And if they say you have, just deny it. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, just deny it. Don't let them know. Just say, no, I haven't worked out for them. So my first trip into Chicago to come work out for the Bulls to do my my individual workout, you know, first of all, you're like, okay, how am I supposed to do this? Because they're flying me commercial into Chicago and picking me up at O'Hare. It's not like I can hide, you know? So Billy picks me up. And back then, you know, you had the car phones that are in the car. You know, they're mounted in the car. You can't take them out. And then Billy liked to give Jerry a hard time. And he goes, watch this. He dials them, and Jerry picks up the phone. And he goes, Agent Orne, it's Agent Blue. I picked up the package. And he goes, cut the shit. You know? And then they take me straight to the hotel. They check me into the Hyatt Deerfield under an alias. I'm not even allowed to check in under my real name.
What's the alias?
I can't even remember. Because you'll also know why I can't remember, because something else happens here at this story. And then they drop me off at like 1 o'clock. And they're like, all right, we'll be back in a couple hours. We're going to come pick you up. And then we're going to go to lunch with Doug. And I'm like, okay. So about three hours later, I get a phone call. Hey, we'll be downstairs in 5 minutes. Meet us outside. And Jerry comes, Doug comes, and we go to one of the Hackney restaurants that's closed at the moment, because they're closed in between lunch and dinner. And we have a private late lunch with the restaurant closed, so nobody will see us. And then they drop me off at the back at the Hyatt and say, hey, we'll be back about 9:30 to get you. And I'm like, 9:30? He goes, yeah, we got to wait for the multiplex to close before we bring you in for your workout, because we don't want anybody there. So that's how secretive it was. So eventually they picked me up at like 9:30 at night.
Unbelievable. They couldn't get a private gym for the workout. They got
to
wait.
But they wanted to use their facility. So
yeah.
No, they bring me in. They take me in the back door. We work out. My workout doesn't end until like midnight. Jerry takes me to one of his little corner restaurants. You know, I'm just dripping in sweat. We sit in some booth. We eat. He takes me back to the hotel, drops me off, says, all right, your ride is picking you up in the morning at 6 a.m. I had like a 7:30 flight or something. It's like AAA cab or whatever. The guy will come in and ask for you. Just get in the car and go to the airport. You don't have to pay him. You don't have to do anything. I'm like, all right. So, you know. By the time I get back to the hotel, it's like 1 o'clock. I get up at 5:30 to catch this cab. I'm sitting in the lobby of the Hyatt, and there's this dude sitting there going, "Hey, I got a ride for I can't remember my name." And he kept saying, and I was like, "I wish this guy would just shut the hell up. Obviously, whoever he's looking for is not here." Then all of a sudden, I remember him at, "Oh yeah, that's my alias. That's me." And I literally got up, jumped in the cab. The guy took me to the airport. And then to finish out the story, the very next workout I have is for, because now at that point, you don't know where the Bulls, they don't have, their pick is like in the 20s, I think, or 16 or 17 or whatever. And then my very next workout is with the Bullets, who had the 12th pick. And back then it was Danny Ferry's dad was the general manager. And you know, I fly into Washington. I have my meeting with him. And the first thing he says to me, he goes, listen, I know you've worked out for the Bulls. You can tell me it's okay. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I haven't worked out for the Bulls. I don't know what you're talking about. He goes, everybody knows you've worked out for the Bulls. And everybody knows Jerry Krause told you, don't tell anybody. But we all know. But he was just very secretive about what he wanted to do, how he wanted to handle things. And to me, that was humorous. But I thought at the end of the day, I thought he knew about basketball. It was just, as you've talked about, Eric, and I'll let BJ be a little more detailed. I thought, unfortunately for Jerry, and God bless his soul, he's passed away, he was really made out to be the villain in those first two episodes. And I'm curious if they do anything in the next eight to try to correct that or kind of balance out where some of this blame lies, because I think there's too many people that feel it's all his fault.
Well, you know, just the follow up quickly, what Will said is, you know, I was probably, I don't know, out of everyone, right? Not only to get drafted there, by Jerry Krause, but I also worked with Jerry for 5 years as assistant general manager. Yep. So the one thing I'll say about Jerry is the following. It's well documented. You know, Jerry was, as the story Will just shared with us, Jerry was very, very, I don't know if I don't want to say secretive, but he wanted things to stay in-house, right? He was very protective of information, and he wanted to keep things, you know, amongst, you know, his people or people that he felt comfortable with or he trusted, right? And it was a very small circle of people. And at that time, you know, there was the emergence of like talk radio. There was the emergence of talk shows that were beginning to sprout up on platforms like ESPN. And as the game became more and more popular, you know, the quest for information became that much greater, right? We went from having maybe two guys, the Chicago Sun-Times and the Chicago Tribune following us, to suddenly there was all these other different, you know, papers and media people that were following the team. So it became that much more difficult to hold on to information. No one can deny this about Jerry, right? With the exception of Michael, Jerry was, under Jerry's watch, every other player and coach, you know, Jerry had input on. We all were there on Jerry's watch, right? Jerry drafted Will. He drafted myself. He drafted Scottie Pippen. He drafted Horace Grant. He traded Charles Oakley to get Bill Cartwright. He hired Phil Jackson, Tex Winters, everybody. And say what you want, right? And we all have our, you know, I just call them underdeveloped areas, right? Jerry was not a media person. He was not going to come out. Jerry was not going to come out and small talk with Will or myself. But we didn't need Jerry to small talk with us. We knew what we had to do, and we were professional enough to understand. But Jerry did that not only once and had a three-peat, he redid the same thing, right? He put another group of 10 guys, because Scotty and Michael were the only other, were the only two remaining players, and did it again. So in the end, you know, it's all about performance. And I think any player who plays in that league or plays professional sports or anything, it's all about the end result. And no one can deny that. And say what you want to say, who's the villain, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. In the end, no one can deny that those teams, right, starting in 1990 or 91, whenever the first championship was, that organization had a run of six championships in an 8 or 9 year window period. And arguably, because Will and I were there together, we felt just as confident if maybe Michael would have came back, that we probably would have had a chance, right? So
oh, yeah.
that's the truth of the matter. And Will was an incredible professional basketball player. And Will understands this, and all of us understood this. Whatever was going on outside of those lines, and that was one of the most, that was one of the proudest things I can say about playing on those teams. No matter what Will had going on outside of those lines, whatever BJ had going on, whatever Michael had going on, Scotty, whatever, when that game started, I've been knowing Will for 25 plus years now. I knew that Will Perdue was going to show up and give me his maximum effort when we stepped in between those lines. And that's the ultimate compliment that you can give someone, to know that I can count on him to give the maximum effort that was necessary. And Will knew that whatever was going on, and we had a lot going on, Will. We had a lot of things going on. We had a lot. But when that game started, for whatever reason, and I don't know what it was, and Will, we were there. Will, it would always be quiet in the locker room. MJ was doing his thing. But when that game started, Will knew that those 12 guys were going to show up and we were going to play. And we knew that we had one focus. And that's what I can say about Jerry. I don't, you know, listen, I saw it. It is what it is. I worked with him, and it wasn't personal. It was business, and the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, oh, sorry. Eric, no, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
I wanted to add two things to what BJ said. You know, just take the Jerry Krause issue one step farther. You know, as BJ said, we all have our weaknesses. And the one thing about Jerry is he just liked to keep things in-house. But he also, as BJ said, as we became more popular, as the game became more popular, as the new TV contract came aboard, you know, talk radio, people needed content, people needed information. Jerry despised, I mean, there's one thing to say, hey, I don't like the media, but he despised the media. He thought the media was the devil. And he, unlike Phil, who knew how to use the media to his advantage to control the narrative, Jerry didn't know how to do that. Jerry was not a people person. But I think BJ could say the same thing. We always, you know, is interesting as he was, as odd as he was, at the end of the day, it was all about one thing, winning a championship. He was, you know, however you want to put it, a weird dude or whatever, but you always felt that Jerry had, or you knew that Jerry had the team's best interest at heart at all times to put us in a position to compete and to give us a realistic chance to win a championship.
So there you have part one of our interview with Will Perdue. Not surprising that two guys whose careers started with Jerry Krause drafting them would provide a perspective that balances the villain narrative he's getting on The Last Dance. And he deserves much of that narrative. But BJ is right. Krause was dealt a pocket ace with Michael Jordan, but he essentially built two dynasties around him. In part two, we'll focus more on Phil Jackson, as well as Will and BJ's departures from the Bulls. You may not recall that Will was traded to the Spurs straight up for Dennis Rodman and won a title under Greg Popovich.
The Pure Hoops podcast is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.